Today is Friday, March 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United States is now the epicenter of the worldwide coronavirus outbreak.
There are now upwards of 82,000, more than China, where the virus originated, and Italy, Europe's epicenter.
Plus, how well are governments responding to the crisis?
So we're seeing a lot of different outcomes, but the most important thing we're seeing differences in, actually, is the rate of response. So how quickly do governments ramp up these measures once they become exposed to the virus?
Those stories and more are next. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has tested positive for the coronavirus. He is currently self-isolating, but will still lead the government's response to the outbreak. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, says the special administrative region in China will ban public gatherings of more than four people to combat the spread of COVID-19. This all comes as U.S. President Donald Trump says the nation needs to reopen for business, even as the U.S. reaches a milestone in the coronavirus pandemic. The AP's Sagar Magani starts us off.
Johns Hopkins University's running tally shows America now has more confirmed virus cases than any other nation, even China, where the virus originated. But the president's been saying for days he wants to ease nationwide guidelines that have kept many Americans home in a bid to stem a further spread.
Our people want to go back to work. I'm hearing it loud and clear from everybody.
He's told the nation's governors the virus impacts regions in different ways, and federal officials are developing guidelines to rate counties by risk of virus spread. The president later told Fox News Channel's Hannity some less impacted areas like the Farm Belt could reopen first. Sagar Magani, Washington.
More than 537,800 people have been infected by the novel coronavirus across the world, and 24,100 have died. That's according to a Johns Hopkins University tally. Infections have also been reported in at least 200 countries and territories since the first cases were identified in China back in December of 2019. As the United States works overtime to screen thousands for the novel coronavirus, a new blood test offers the chance to find out who may have immunity, a potential game changer in the battle to contain infections and get the economy back on track. Reuters' Gloria So has that story.
Tests for the coronavirus are limited in the United States, which means people who aren't showing strong signs of the disease are likely to go undetected. A new blood test could change that, as the country works overtime to screen thousands for the virus and contain it. These tests can quickly identify disease-fighting antibodies in those who might be infected but have few or no symptoms. All it takes is a prick of the finger, different from the current diagnostic test with a nasal swab that can be hard to come by. California-based BioMerica is among private companies already selling the test outside the U.S. They say their kit sells for less than $10. Company CEO Zach Irani-Cohen warns, though, that just because someone has antibodies doesn't mean they're COVID-proof.
What our test tells you is that they've been exposed to COVID-19, are producing antibodies to COVID-19, okay? And there are some papers that suggest that they will have a likely immunity to it. So there are clinical studies that suggest that they will have a likely immunity to it. COVID-19 is very new. It is novel, and so we don't have all the answers yet.
Disease experts say COVID-19 immunity could last for several months or more than a year based on other coronavirus studies. But they also caution there's no way to know for sure, and it could be different from person to person. Tony Mazzulli is the chief microbiologist of Toronto's Sinai Health System.
If somebody has recovered, hopefully they've made the appropriate immune response and therefore you can find these antibodies. The two questions are those antibodies enough to protect them from getting reinfected? So can they go back to work, to school, you know, their daily activities knowing I'm immune? And how long would they last?
Questions remain over how accurate the tests are and how they would be rolled out. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said it is working on its own version of antibody tests, but it has not given a timetable.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. The leaders of the world's foremost industrialized nations convened via teleconference on Thursday to discuss the global coronavirus outbreak. White House correspondent Patsy Wita-Kuswara has that story.
In New York City, National Guard soldiers begin converting a convention center into a temporary medical facility to ease a hospital bed shortage as part of the state's response to the COVID-19 outbreak. President Donald Trump and leaders of the G20, the world's foremost industrialized nations, teleconference Thursday morning to discuss the global response.
We have a lot of different ideas, a lot of good ideas. We're working together. The leaders gathered virtually around the world to discuss the whole subject of the problem that right now 151 nations have got.
Trump again called for opening parts of the country soon to salvage the economy, but public health experts warn against relaxing social distancing guidelines too soon.
We want to see some evidence that infections are slowing to the point where we may feel comfortable releasing some of the restrictions slowly, while also having a plan in place to rapidly identify additional cases and to isolate them critically.
With more than 81,000 cases in the U.S. and deaths surpassing 1,000, criticism has been mounting overseas about the Trump administration's approach.
My expectations are that things are going to get far worse before they get better. We, in the past, have been a leader for the world. I think very few people in the world now are looking toward the United States for leadership.
The virtual summit was called by the current G20 chairman, Saudi King Salman. In a statement after the meeting, the G20 announced they will inject more than $5 trillion into the global economy, share more health data, and address potential trade disruptions. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Malaysia is the world's top supplier of medical gloves. Manufacturers are warning of a global shortage because of the government's partial lockdown on the country, just as the coronavirus-driven demand is soaring worldwide. Malaysia currently meets more than half of the global demand for the gloves. The country, however, has the highest number of confirmed. The country, however, does have the highest number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Southeast Asia and issued a movement control order on March 18th that extends through April 14th in hopes of slowing the infection rate. International and domestic travel is restricted, and non-essential businesses have been ordered closed. That's just one of the many responses governments have taken to combat the pandemic. Now, the University of Oxford's Blavatnik School of Government has launched a COVID-19 government response tracker. It aggregates data from 73 countries so far, including China, South Korea, Italy, Britain, Canada, and the United States. I spoke with Thomas Hale, Associate Professor of Global Public Policy at the Blavatnik School, about this research project via Skype.
So we see a general trend toward increasing stringency of measures, more school closings, more workplace closings, more travel restrictions, etc. But we see a lot of variation in the levels governments have got to already. Some are already at a very high rate of stringency, even with relatively few cases like Croatia or some of the other Eastern European countries. Some are still a bit downplaying things. We see that, for example, in Brazil. Others are following the sort of whiplash pattern where they play it down at first, but then quickly correct as the number of cases begins to grow. So we're seeing a lot of different outcomes. But the most important thing we're seeing differences in, actually, is the rate of response. So how quickly do governments ramp up these measures once they become exposed to the virus? In some countries, the rate of stringency increases sort of in line and with the rate of cases. In other countries, it lags it. And unfortunately, in the U.S. and the U.K. are two countries where that lag has been a bit larger.
Given that the study is relatively new, how much data do you think that you need to collect globally? How much time, how many different countries before you can make some good policy recommendations as to what has worked in the past?
The trick is really the lag in how quickly the gap between when people become infected and when we see their cases entering our data. So because there's this up to 2-week kind of delay and when symptoms take effect, and of course, before people become identified as cases, that means that government policies from 2 weeks ago are the ones that we need to study to understand the effect now. So unfortunately, we're going to be a little bit behind the curve in that sense of identifying what works. But like I said, we're seeing a big explosion in a number of countries where 2 weeks ago stringency was much lower. And I think we'll be able to measure that increasingly well going forward.
How can you disseminate your results in a meaningful way?
Yeah, making this data accessible and useful is really at the heart of our project. So everything we collect is immediately available on the website in real time. We'll be able to make that is now public for anyone to take and use. We think it's really important to do that because, as I was saying, we're a little bit slow at the moment in our responses. To get ahead of this, we need governments to begin to adapt in real time based on what the evidence base shows us works or doesn't work. And we're not going to do that if we're not sharing this information as quickly as possible. You know, viruses mutate and move very fast, but we, Team Humanity, can innovate and we can also move fast if we work together and collaborate on this way and follow the evidence.
Thomas Hale is an associate professor of global policy at Oxford University's Blavatnik School. And coming up later...
This crisis is a great opportunity for all the museums to make their collection accessible.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists in Chicago discovered the oldest solid material ever found on Earth, trapped inside a meteorite that fell in Australia 50 years ago. What they found are grains of stardust, microscopic remnants of stars that died billions of years ago that can go on to help form new stars, planets, or other objects like meteorites. The ancient bits of stardust are actually tiny grains of pre-solar silicon carbide that were created long before our sun formed 4.6 billion years ago. To determine the age of the stardust, the scientists measured its exposure to high-energy cosmic rays that fly through the galaxy. Using that dating technique, the researchers found the grains of stardust are between 4.6 to 7 billion years old. The scientists' findings were published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Native American tribes in the United States fear their COVID-19 outbreak could have a devastating effect on them. Brian Newland is the tribal chairman of the Bay Mills Reservation of the Sault Ste. Marie Bands of Chippewa Indians in Michigan. Newland told VOA's Jason Patinkin that the COVID-19 outbreak threatens some tribes' very existence.
One of the big challenges we face is that culturally we lead very communal lifestyles. So we have a lot of homes where multiple generations of family members live together, a lot of informal care networks in our communities where everybody takes care of everybody else. So if you tell people, don't ask grandmother or your aunt to watch your kid, that's unusual and it makes it hard for you to shelter in place. Or if you have an adult sibling or a neighbor who relies on you for a meal once a week, or just to check in and make sure they're okay, and you take that away from somebody, it makes it hard for them to live their daily lives. So when you have folks who rely upon those community care networks, and you layer on top of that a cultural way of life that is built around being together, it makes you especially vulnerable to the spread of infectious disease.
What about in terms of the healthcare aspect?
In our community, we have a pretty well-developed tribal healthcare system and health center, but it's what we call a primary care facility. We don't have intensive care units on our reservation. We don't have ventilators, and we have actually very few test kits for the coronavirus or other protective equipment for the healthcare workers. The nearest hospital is 25 miles away. And so if you have people in our community who get sick, they're going to be transported competing with others off the reservation for those types of resources. Now, there are a lot of tribal communities in the United States that are even more rural and remote than we are. And in some places, they might be 100 miles from a hospital with intensive care units and ventilators. People in those communities often have very few resources to make those trips on their own. Very few tribal communities have access to the type of care you would need if you contracted the coronavirus.
With any community on Earth, a disease that seems to target the elderly is vicious. But particularly for tribes, I think it's even more so because of the knowledge, the history, the culture, the language that resides in those elderly individuals. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, you really hit the nail on the head, because for a lot of tribes, the ability to speak our languages fluently has diminished over the years because of federal government policies and education policies. Indian children were basically told you are not allowed to speak your language or you'll be punished. So the people who have the ability to pass that knowledge on are the most vulnerable from the coronavirus. In some tribal communities, there may only be two or three people who have that ability to speak their language fluently. Losing that connection with your culture would be devastating to your very existence, our very existence as Indigenous people.
That was Brian Newland, the tribal chairman of the Bay Mills Reservation of the Sault Ste. Marie Bands of Chippewa Indians. He was speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. The coronavirus pandemic has shuttered Europe's museums, theaters, and concert halls, but artistic expression is flourishing anyway, at least online. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports on the cultural offerings for a lockdown audience and COVID-19's impact on the industry.
How about an evening with the Berlin Philharmonic, a crowd-free visit to the Louvre Museum?
Zulex working? Flex rotate even more?
Joining a dance class with the Dutch National Ballet. Or attending a concert by Spanish singer Danny J. As COVID-19 puts more and more European countries under lockdown, the region's cultural and creative industries are getting creative. Audiences may be forced to stay home, but they've got a truly movable online feast for free. The lineup includes professionals and amateurs, like this YouTube recording of a balcony concert in Italy, now a tradition since the country went under lockdown this month. Also online art exhibits like the Klimt collection at Austria's Belvedere Museum or post-impressionism at the Munch Museum in Oslo.
This crisis is a great opportunity for all the museums to make their collection accessible.
David Villaume chairs the executive board of the Network of European Museum Organizations, and he also directs the German Museums Association.
There is also an opportunity to try new ways to reach the audience. For example, you see everywhere now very easy done visit of the museum made by the director or made just by one person with the smartphone.
Here in the French capital, the Paris Philharmonic is joining European counterparts in putting some of its greatest concerts online. The Philharmonic Secretary General Hugues de Saint-Simon.
You can really feel the atmosphere and the tension that you have in the concert. But it's also an activity that you can do with your family, that you can share. More than 80% of the people watching our concerts online, we didn't know them. They never come on our website. So that means it's a lot of new audiences. So that was great.
But COVID-19 is also dealing Europe's cultural institutions and artists a major financial blow. It's far too early to estimate the impact, but it will be sizable, especially for those living on the edge. Financial support announced so far by some European governments can only cover a fraction of the losses.
The government said that they would pay everything that should have been paid by the companies but we don't know exactly how and when. And so the major point for us is what to do so the artists are not too fragilized.
European museums share these concerns.
There is also a lot of threats also, or a lot of problems. You know, private museums now in some countries in Europe doesn't have access to an emergency fund to help them to pay their bills.
coronavirus is taking its toll in other ways. It's infected artists like Italian opera star Placido Domingo and Cameroonian jazz legend Manu Dibango, who died in Paris this week. But Dibango's music goes on, and so does Europe's cultural scene. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Today, Friday, March 27th, is national correspondent Jim Malone's last day with The Voice of America. He's wrapping up a 37-year career in which he's covered Africa, the U.S. Congress, and so much more. Before he enters retirement, I spoke to him about covering the U.S. political beat.
Mostly, I've been interested in trying to frame things in a greater and more general context over the years and provide kind of analysis that gets beyond the daily back and forth. You certainly have to be aware of the latest developments, but I think it's also important to be able to pull back on these major election debates or issues of the day and try to find some kind of sense of it in a broader context and sort of get away from the moment-to-moment hyperactivity that you might find on Twitter or other aspects of social media coverage. And that's a great challenge because, you know, for voters, their attention span is much less than it used to be.
You've been with VOA for 37 years now. You know, looking back over your career, you know, what are some of the highlights that you look back on fondly with your coverage, not only with politics, but with other areas that you've been with VOA?
Yeah, I mean, I started with VOA after I had been a Peace Corps volunteer in Africa. I was in the small nation of what was then called Swaziland in the late 70s and early 80s. And my first experiences at VOA were with the English to Africa division, which has a very loyal audience following. And I think both my time overseas and my time there crystallized how listeners and viewers overseas are interested in what goes on in the United States and our political system, and how you have to sort of cater to their interests in a different way than you would an American domestic audience. So that's something I've looked to hone over the years. I also think my experience covering Congress in the early 90s was instructive because there was no better place to see the conflicting currents of this large and complicated country come together than, say, on the floor of the House of Representatives. 435 people representing a huge country of over 300 million, and you saw all those competing interests sort of clashing and coming together on a daily basis, and how, for the most part, you know, that institution was able to work out the differences and come to some sort of compromise at times. But I have to say also, in the 2000s, to watch the rise of the Tea Party, their political mantra was no more compromise. And so we've seen a much greater political polarization in recent decades, and sort of a political tribalism in our political parties that, you know, is a bit disturbing moving forward. There are always signs of bipartisanship. We saw it as Congress tried to come together to help with the coronavirus outbreak and an aid package. There are signs of it, but, you know, our political differences are always there for all to see, and it's going to be a concern moving forward. It has been a great privilege and pleasure trying to follow all these great sort of dynamic changes in the country politically over the years and to find them out through the voices of real Americans and, you know, present those views on VOA and try to give people around the world a deeper understanding of how complex our country is. And, you know, it is a democracy, but it's often messy. It's not always neat. And it's always evolving. And so to try to crystallize all that for listeners, viewers, and readers overseas has been a great challenge, but also a great source of satisfaction over the years.
Jim, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you and working with you these last few years, and I wish you the absolute best as you set off for retirement.
Steve, thanks so much, and the same goes for you. I wish you the best as always.
And with that, that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition. on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend.